Welcome to the Impactful Innovators podcast series. This series is produced from the fall 2020 class at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and sponsored by the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship at RPI. This series highlights the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs, and intrapreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond. Today's episode will feature Brent Salina, class of 2012. He is the founder and CTO of Microorganic Technologies. Brent studied biochemistry and biophysics while at RPI, and that is where he learned about the power of microbial fuel cells, microscopic bacteria that digest waste and produce tiny amounts of energy while doing so. Brent decided to put those bugs to work in the wastewater industry, which had not seen technological advances in decades. Brent graduated RPI with a bachelor's in biochemistry and biophysics.
My name is Brent Salina. I'm a 2011 or 2012 BCBP grad, depending on how you slice it. The difference there is I actually was able to take a co-op for my company while I was an undergrad. And, you know, obviously that's how I got to know Kelly and Jason. Is as a student there, I became interested in entrepreneurship after meeting the Ecovative guys, who are a speaker series later this season. And the long and short of it is I enjoyed my biochemistry time. The professor that I worked under is actually on this call. I was fortunate enough to have a lot of research experience my freshman year, but it became pretty clear that I was only ever going to be an okay researcher. When I started working with the Ecovative folks is when I sort of realized that the entrepreneurial pathway was a lot more accessible than people tend to think. As we mentioned, BCBP grad, the founder of Microorganic, that's part of the reason why I'm here talking today. I also happen to have a passion for growing carnivorous plants, and I'm an avid adventure and dual sport rider. Those last two aren't particularly relevant to what we're going to be talking about today, though. So I was excited to do this talk, but there's a few points that I wanted to cover up front. First is that, you know, I'm going to be sharing my story about our technology, our opportunity, and how we assaulted it. But especially as you go through the speaker series this year, you'll notice that there's no single right way to do innovation. You know, by definition, you're doing something that other people haven't done before, and you're creating something that doesn't really exist. There's not going to be a precise formula to that, although certainly there are overarching tones. So as you go through all of this, you know, it's important to remember that what I'm presenting you is my experience, and you're meant to take the best of it and how it applies to, you know, your thought process and what you're looking to do, which dovetails really nicely into a second guidepost here, which is that no one really knows what they're doing with this stuff. The world around you is not there by design. It is what's endured. Through trial and error, what you see around you is something that seemed to make sense, but very little of it is, you know, the intended product that people had, you know, when they were producing it. Point C is just a good life tip that speaking in contradictions is a helpful tool for creating dramatic effect, which brings us to point D, that there is only one right way to do innovation, and that's whatever gets it done. You'll see that as a recurring theme. Another thing, and I had talked to Jason and Kelly about this, is you see innovation and entrepreneurship presented a lot of ways without the negatives or, you know, with kind of a rosy view of it. And I think it is important to acknowledge in and of yourself that you're capable of great things. But it is important to ask the question, you know, do you want to change the world? Certainly, I've stuck with this for about 10 years now. But at any point, I always felt that I was being enriched both in what I was learning and in the kind of people and connections that I was making, that it has always been worth it. And my point is that there's a lot of different versions of success. If what success looks like for commercializing a dating app or a file sharing platform, you know, is very different. There's a timeline component to it. And on top of that, I just want to drive home that I'm going to present a lot of the challenges we went over, and you are under no obligation to meet those. Any experience you have with entrepreneurship and innovation pays dividends in terms of the people you meet, the resume building. You'll bring that knowledge to any project you're managing, any project you're budgeting moving forward. Don't let long-term challenges dissuade you from, you know, trying a little bit. And because of how difficult this process gets, I've always found it very helpful to have guideposts and sanity checks for whether or not sticking with your concept and your idea made sense. These are going to be different person to person, but for me, they were always very simple. One, is what I'm doing valuable? You know, is there still a monetary value and a good to the world that I'm capable of producing? Two, is it possible? Clearly, if I was developing a time travel machine, that would certainly be valuable, but it's not something that, you know, I can physically do. And then three, which is the trickiest one to answer, is it possible for me? Cold fusion is a great thing. I am not equipped to build that in my garage. Similarly, if you're developing a pharmaceutical product, you're never going to be able to not undergo FDA trials. So there's certain things that as you develop your process, you'll have to realize are hard gates that you'll have to pass through. This is where we get into more of the specifics of the story and what we're doing. Typically, you're taught to start with the why of what you do, especially for a technical presentation. However, for that, again, I'm going to refer you to point A, that there's no right way to do this, because it's just not the path we took. I fell in love with the technology and what it was capable of before I really had a solid fit. I knew that there were a lot of different manifestations of it, and we just kind of started adding value to the field as a whole before we really knew what the actual product manifestation was going to look like. This is where we started. You know, again, I'm a biochemist, biophysicist by education, and I've always been enamored with the molecular machinery that is biology. From a design standpoint, life has a very vested interest in living. So you have billions of years of evolution that have created a molecular toolbox for survival on this planet, which conveniently also happens to be where I live and planned on innovating. What you see there, that eye chart, is a biochemical pathway map that shows all of the equipment that a given cell has to shuttle around organic molecules to suit its purpose. What's always been interesting to me about that is something like a car can only run off 87 octane gas, but any other living thing can consume a very wide variety of organic materials. And it's because of the breadth of interactions that you see there. Microbial fuel cells take all of that science that you see there, all of that electron transfer that's happening, and they funnel it to one specific point. What we do is to take advantage of the fact that all life is chemistry, and therefore all chemistry being electron transfer, all life is electric. We let those microbes push electrons into a wire, allowing them to literally breathe lightning. We grow a layer of microorganisms on the anode, shown there on the left. They deposit electrons as they breathe that go up and over through a wire, where they're eventually deposited on atmospheric oxygen. There's a reason I'm doing some of the technical details we'll get into, but this is where I fell in love with this tech. With no moving parts, no precious metals, no rare earth metals, we're able to get DC power directly from anything that decomposes. That's the kind of thing that you don't need to have immediately a application for to realize that that has enormous potential. And that gets us into the why of all of this. And the short answer is because we have some challenges ahead of us. We are rapidly running out of fresh water. With rising oceans, you're seeing more and more saltwater infiltration. The global improvement of quality of life that's happened, unprecedented in our time, unfortunately also depends on us continually mining carbon from the ground and throwing it in the air, which is going to continue to make this cycle worse. In spite of all of that, and again, when I started learning about this technology, there's energy all around us. You know, again, a pile of leaves has enough energy to get you from Albany to Buffalo. Your car just can't run on it. So we started looking at a technology that can do energy positive desalination that, you know, again, has no precious metals or rare earth components. That's the kind of thing that seems to be worth spending a significant portion of your effort on. Which brings me to kind of the first bullet point here, which is be flexible, but focus. Again, speaking in contradictions is a great oratory technique here. Early on, what we realized is that microbial fuel cells were inherently very valuable, but we also realized that they wouldn't do anything without doing one thing first. And that brought us to our first use case of this technology, which was something that was very important, but was possibly the least exciting application of the technology. And that is wastewater treatment. So for this amazing world-changing technology, it turns out you have to start with sewage. What you're seeing there is a process called aeration. It involves putting air directly into the water so the microbes can break down the waste. It happens 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and most people are surprised to find out it's about 3 to 7% of all of the energy use in the United States. So about 7 cents on every dollar spent on power in the US goes to throwing air into sewage. That's an enormous amount, and yet there's 7 times the energy within that sewage than is needed for that process. And at the end of the day, this is a technology that saved more lives than antibiotics. So it is absolutely critical that we have a way to do this energy efficiently in the future. So again, going back to our guideposts here, is what you're doing valuable? If you want to live on this planet, certainly seems that way. And given how much energy is being expended on it, certainly someone would be willing to pay for it if you could solve that problem. Is it possible? For us, that part was painfully obviously yes. There is a very large academic community around the technology who's doing a great job. They just had missing parts associated with the commercialization and rollout. Which brings us to the last point, is it possible for me? Is this something that I can acquire the means to actually be able to do? And again, as I say there, that part was obvious and obviously painful because it meant that we would be doing a lot of scale-up technology around a lot of sewage, and that's not the most fun in the world. And this is where we really get into kind of the narrative and sort of the fun part. I promise now I don't need to dwell on the tech as much. This is a picture that Kelly had from some of our first pitches. Kelly gets credit for the joke that the only thing worse than the blur on the camera is how badly that suit fits me. But everything starts somewhere. And for us, it started with about 30 different failed business plan competitions. You know, again, we basically got out there and said, hey, here's this really cool technology. We think it can do a lot of different things. But forming that into a cohesive value proposition, and not only that, but formulating a use of proceeds, a budget, that was a trial by fire. We did not enter having any damn clue knowing what we were doing. That was something that we developed just by bumping into it. But we made progress quickly. That was actually us and when we started. The previous unit that we showed was actually our closest competitor. So we're out there pitching, talking about how this technology is going to change the world. They've got those large shipping containers installed at picturesque wineries. And this was our lab at that point. This is 2012. Again, from a strictly innovation standpoint, one of the reasons that I stuck with this technology was that you could make scientific progress in that setting, believe it or not. You didn't need pure cultures for the microbes, so this was something that you could make scientific progress in with a lot of resources, despite the outward appearance. And sure enough, as the years rolled on, we were able to get out into the field more. In 2014, we got out into the field more. And again, we realized we weren't going to be able to do hardcore material innovation. So we focused on adding value to system scale-up, system operations, and the kind of thing that you just wouldn't see from the academic community. That wound up being a hard road. Turns out making the electrodes was an incredibly difficult process. Because we didn't have the resources in-house, we wound up focusing pretty extensively on toll manufacturing and working on equipment that we could rent by the hour. That gave us an enormous business plan advantage. Turns out the sales process for municipal equipment is pretty damn convoluted. A wastewater treatment plant, if they know they need upgrades, is gonna hire an engineering firm who's gonna do design over the course of a year. In the process of developing that design, they're gonna work with different equipment rep firms to spec the individual equipment. And so as a newcomer to this space, it's very hard to break in. With our focus on scaled manufacturing, which again came from the fact that we didn't have lab facilities to do it by hand, what we realized is that we were in effect generating a manufacturing capacity that the larger entities would find interesting. And that brought us to a business model that's very similar to like microprocessors and phones. You can't go out and buy, you know, a Qualcomm processor, but you're very interested in having the fastest one in your phone. And we realized we could do that in the microbial field space. The big entities don't know how to make these electrodes or have any idea what we're talking about when we say electric bugs, But because we're developing IP and know-how in large-scale manufacturing, we can provide that for them at a price. And this gets us into not just the business 101, but the more experiential side of how this all went. That was a great idea, but at the end of the day, you will miscalculate. You know, bullet point B, no one knows what they're doing. We had the right idea, but our electrodes kind of sucked, plain and simple. We were making progress on that, but we significantly overestimated the maturity of the innovation pipeline, which is a very fancy way of saying no one knew what we were talking about and they weren't terribly interested in learning. In something like solar, if you have a solar catalyst, or in battery tech, if you have something that increases the performance, there's somebody somewhere who will evaluate that. They've got a metric for how interested they are in that. There was no analogy to that for wastewater treatment, and for anybody considering going down this path, I think properly gauging the innovation pipeline, especially if you're focusing on a B2B strategy, is really critical. Otherwise, you need to make sure you've got funding in place to endure a very long learning curve. We did not. We lost our funding. More accurately, we ran it out. As a result, we lost most of our team. Turns out people like to get paid. And that, again, at that point, brought us back to those central guideposts we had. At each of these junctures, you're sort of faced with this decision of pivot, move on, or double down. And that's a personal decision for you. And, you know, I looked at that where we were, and I had no people at that point, but was what we were working on valuable? Definitely. Is it possible? I was even more sure. We had made progress. We had more problems identified, and they all seemed surmountable. Is it possible for me? We had been getting better. I had access to better equipment. I knew what I was doing much more for large-scale manufacturing at that point. My electrochemical knowledge was getting better, and we had better connections, and we were starting to get people who cared about this stuff. It's at this point that I kind of introduced another bullet point in this metric, which is anybody else going to do this? That one was important because at that point, this was starting to get tiresome. You know, it was a long road. But this was a technology that I desperately feel needs to be more than a footnote, and it was painfully clear to me that nobody else was going to make that happen. Which brings us to one of the biggest points is, no matter what the concept is, you have to go places, you have to talk to people, you have to do things, do every conference you can, talk to everybody in every academic field that's tangentially related that you can. Some of that is the connections, some of that is helping you build your value proposition, but it's also critically important to your sanity in the process. It sounds a little dramatic, but when I say kill your heroes in this, I had been going to academic conferences, and what I came to find out is that a lot of the problems and a lot of the ways that our electrodes were having difficulties, some of the top leaders in the field were having the exact same problems, they just weren't writing papers about that. So that was a huge sanity check for me that, yes, you know, we're actually making progress on this issue that everybody has and nobody's talking about. So again, no one knows what they're doing. You have to get out there and you have to talk to people to be confident in where you stand in the field and where you want to go next. And this brings us to just one of the most difficult parts to pitch of our history. Improving the electrodes was the right thing to do. It is a thoroughly unsexy bit of progress to share. For a long time, we had graphs like this that we were trying to use to get engagement both from end users and potential investors. And my partner at the time had one of the most difficult jobs ever in terms of making people excited about graphs like this. We were creating a large volume of samples of material. We were making progress, but explaining that is difficult. That being said, this graph in particular wound up being worth about $750,000 when we were finally able to get a NSF Phase 2 SBIR, or at least it wound up being a preliminary award. So I struggled a lot about how to present this, but given that the series is supposed to be a little bit about the personal side of these journeys, it's something that I did want to put out there. I say we got preliminarily awarded that Phase 2 SBIR because around the same time that we started generating that data and we made traction on that grant, I also found out that I was in need of some pretty major surgery. Without getting too much into it, I had a leaky heart valve. They wound up breaking most of my ribs, bunch of plates, Teflon ring around the heart, bunch of mesh. It was not exactly something light, and I wound up losing $750K about 2 weeks before I went into surgery. And again, that was after 2 years of a hard restart of making all that data at essentially in a basement. So the takeaway is Murphy is always watching. What can happen will happen, and you need to be prepared for eventualities. A big part of the reason I shared this is not a story of toughness and grit, but it really is the fact that you're not obligated to do this for anyone. It's something you can choose to do, but you need to be clear to yourself about why you're in this and what your goals are. Again, and you're starting to see now why I kind of belabored the structure here. So you get out of that surgery, and the hardest part, believe it or not, wasn't the surgery. That was always going to be a success. It was always going to suck, but it was going to be fine. Man, as much as you get a clap for that, no one writes you an investment check for having endured that. There is a hard stigma to shake off of being 27 and having gone in for heart surgery, especially in a town like Albany. It is very difficult to raise money at that point. So we were operating on very little budget. Things were very, very difficult. And again, you have to go back to the guideposts that you've laid out for yourself. Is it still valuable? Yes. Is it still possible? Absolutely, yes. We were on track before this sidestep. Is it possible for me? And this is where you kind of look at it, and again, you can throw in the towel, but I sort of went the other direction and said, well, it can't really get any harder at this point, right? Like, we've gotten this far. And again, this is where I went back to the last criteria, is anyone else going to do this if I don't? And Kelly's heard me say it, but man, I just wish I had a competitor that would have taken me off the board at that point. Like, I would have happily moved on knowing that it was going to get done. But that wasn't the case, so you just kind of calmly move on to what you got to do. And you can be filled with about it, and that'll get you through a tough week, a tough month, maybe a tough year. But if you want to make it for the long haul, you have to have kind of a calm evaluation of this kind of situation. But we were able to get there. Again, there are things you can do, great things you can do, even in a basement. We started building out from the samples that we had generated, we were able to make larger versions of the electrodes, and we were able to finally get back in the field. The hardware you're seeing there doesn't look like much, but the electrodes it housed were something that others had thrown $30 million at and couldn't get done. So the unit you're seeing there was deployed at Brown's Brewing up in Hoosick Falls. That was sort of our first entrance back into the field. That went very, very well. We learned a lot of different technical things that I won't get into unless someone has a specific interest. The following year, we got a little bit bigger yet. With that data, we were able to secure a grant through the state of Massachusetts. This is at the Pittsfield Wastewater Treatment Plant. One thing that I love about this photo is each of those tanks is about the size of the kitchen you saw earlier in the slide deck here. I always like that for scale. And we were able to make what was and is the world's biggest microbial fuel cell. Most of these things in the world are about the size of a shoebox or a car battery, and those electrodes that you see there are taller than I am. So we hit a huge milestone that we now got to the point where we're not talking about looking graphs anymore. We've got a honest-to-goodness full-size microbial fuel cell that we can point at people, and that's where they start to really get excited. This is what that implementation looks like. This is where we knew that despite what all outward appearances looked like, we were doing something that nobody else was going to do, is you needed the academic knowledge and the willingness to get out. We poured that concrete pad, all of that plumbing I installed myself in negative 20 degree weather in the Berkshires in February. No tenured professor is going to sign up to do that. One, it's not what they're best at, and two, it's not that fun. On the flip side, normally that's where industry would pick up, but there had just been a failure to pass that baton. The academic field and what traditionally would be the pipeline to get that into the field had failed to connect, and somebody had to make that union. And that's why this past February was just one of the most exciting times in my life. In October, we had, with the data from that pilot that you just saw, we went to Aquatech in Amsterdam. Amsterdam overseas, not Amsterdam 20 minutes down the highway here. And we were finally able to connect to large entities to start having those discussions about those B2B relationships that really put meat on the skeleton of the business model, further driving home the point that you need to get out there and talk to people. I had been working trade shows in the US for, I'd say, 6 years at that point. It took me one in the right place before I was talking to an entity that was everything that I hoped it would be and more. So that's about when I was able to give that presentation at Startup Tech Valley. We were finally had all the pieces. We've got our unit in the field. We've got a customer that we're in, big conversations with. The data is streaming in. This whole time we've been increasing the quality of the mechanical build. All the pieces are coming together. And then you guys kind of know the rest. That was February 2020, and Murphy is always watching. Certainly the progress that we have is still on the table. We're still in those conversations, but risk of B2B, large things like that impact people's budgets and their strategic focus. And one more time, pivot, move on, or double down. Is it still valuable? Yes. Is it possible? Yes. Is it possible for me? Yes, we're doing it. Is anybody else going to do it? I don't care because it's going to be us this time around. Those kind of guideposts are incredibly important. Wrapping all of this up, there's a reason this pitch isn't that polished. There's a reason I don't mind that a lot of these photos are blurry. There's a reason if you go on our website, it's not as slick as some software pitches. And that's because, again, there is no single right way to do innovation. What we found when we have had more polish on it is it helped, but only so much. And it ultimately wound up distracting from a lot of what was leading to those B2B interactions that we desperately needed. More to the point, we stayed a very small company. When we lost all of our folks, we never really staffed up because what we found is that we were able to engage contract engineering, contract manufacturing, and what I found is that I don't need a mechanical engineer 12 months out of the year. I need them intensely for different projects, and then after that, I intensely need a chemical engineer. So for us, success didn't look like having a lot of full-time employees. And I think that's important is you can't really have a preconception about what your journey is going to look like or what it's going to take for you to get to your goal. You have to be open to that changing. And again, I certainly didn't know that at the start. You know, I plan to be wrong about a lot more things. And again, no one knows what they're doing. Steve's just a good life tip for y'all. But the only thing, if you remember one thing other than the crazy guy talking about sewage, it's that you guys can learn an awful lot from Jason and Kelly. But there is only one right way to do innovation, and that's whatever gets it done. It is the one thing that you are judged solely by the success of accomplishing your mission. FedEx only exists because the guy took his payroll and played blackjack with it. There are a million ways to do this story, and I hope you at least dip your toes into finding out yours.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Impactful Innovators podcast series. Be sure to continue listening as we explore more of the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. Thank you again to the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube, share it with a friend, or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond.